Well, it's becoming more and more dangerous to your emotional health to watch the news in recent weeks, and I think especially just in the last couple of weeks. I heard a news reporter just yesterday who was giving a rundown of the various crises that have developed just over the course of this summer, and in many of them just in the last week or so. He took a deep breath and he sighed and he said, "The world is coming unraveled." And I think we would agree. It's not that it's ever been all that raveled, but it's becoming much, much more confused, chaotic, and dangerous. Iraq has simply fallen apart in the last couple of months. What's happening there today is just an absolute tragedy and a heartbreaking situation. The brutal murders of people who are simply religious rivals of these radical Islamists. What a terrible thing is happening there. In the United States, could we do anything? Should we do anything? Would it be helpful to try to do anything? We could probably all have our own opinion about that. We'd like to see something happen to help those people. There's a condition between Israel and the Palestinians and the Gaza Strip and the area near there on both sides of that border. Again, all full-out war taking place in that region. The Syrian civil war continues. It's hard to estimate. Well over 100,000 people, most of them just innocent civilians, have been killed. Civil wars are always the most bloody and always the most painful. And this one certainly is. Ukraine continues to be a tug of war between Russia and those in Ukraine who want to remain independent. And again, the United States, what could we do? What should we do? Who knows what if there is a solution to that. But it's very frustrating. It's sad. It makes me feel angry even to look at these things developing and to see the people that are suffering. The outrageous claim by this ISIS group that they're going to raise the flag of Allah at the White House. You know, it makes you want to reach through the TV screen and poke that guy in the nose. what an insulting and really enraging thing that is to say. In many cases, many are very critical of the foreign policy of our current leadership, but I don't know who would have a better idea. I don't know who could solve those issues. I think we understand that they probably couldn't be solved regardless of who our leaders are, but the ones that are in position now certainly seem to be intent on fulfilling the prophecy of Leviticus 26, that the pride of our power would be broken. War is not necessarily the answer. Nothing in this age is the answer. So we look forward in the next couple of months to a celebration of a period of time that shows us and any who are willing to understand it and receive it what those answers are, how this world will be set back, will become raveled instead of unraveled, and the problems will be resolved. As we watch, as we observe, as we're hurt by what we see happening in the world and in our own nation, we have plenty of our own personal concerns too. We've got plenty to deal with. If the world was a safe and secure and stable place, we'd still have plenty on our mind, just because of our personal situations, our concerns, our issues, our trials. So we deal with both. As we deal with our own personal situation, it is important that we be aware of what's happening in this world and, in general, understand the significance of those events and of the trends. Matthew 24 and 25, we find a prophecy given by Jesus Christ. It was given when his disciples asked how they could recognize the end of the age in anticipation of his return. This passage is known as the Olivet Prophecy because, as you see in the first verse, that it was given on the Mount of Olives. Interesting setting, because they were able to sit and probably see behind or in the distance across the valley the Temple Mount, where the temple stood. And Jesus made some initial prophecies about that temple itself. We always ask, where are we now? Where are we now in terms of prophetic events? Well, we're somewhere short of the conclusion. That's about as close as I'll get you this afternoon or this morning. We'd like to have a timeline, wouldn't we? I kind of picture this often, and what I would like to do personally, maybe as a Bible study project, to develop a timeline. I'd like to go back to Genesis 12. I could go back further, but let's start with Abraham. Probably in about the year 1972 or so BC is when Abraham was born. And you could take this timeline and place on it markers that would represent events that have taken place since that time. And there'd be an incredible amount of detail on that kind of a timeline. And some of the dates would be estimates, but at least we could put them in some kind of a sequential order, see when they happen in relation to one another. We'd find along this timeline the development of the nation of Israel, and they're being brought out of Egypt. They're being established as a nation, being brought together under the United Kingdom that David and Solomon ruled over. There's their separation into two distinct nations. We'd see the warnings of the prophets, the sins of the people. We'd see later the destruction of those nations as time passes, and we arrive at the time of Jesus Christ. And there'd be a number of points we could put on the timeline that would represent what he did and the message that he brought. And we follow that timeline into the New Testament church and the time of the apostles. Eventually, as you follow that timeline across, you come to the point where we are today. Now, that would be kind of moving to the right, wouldn't it, as we pass from one day, one season to the next. But we'd be making progress toward the conclusion, the end of that timeline. Eventually, it would take you to the millennium, and then to the white throne judgment, and then to the lake of fire, and then the new heavens and the new earth. That's where it would end for us. But that, frankly, is just the beginning of eternity. If we could develop such a timeline, it wouldn't fit on your note paper. Even if you turned it landscape, it's not going to fit. In fact, it probably wouldn't fit on one of these walls if you really wanted to be able to expand it and show the detail. Yet it's a timeline that we kind of carry around in our heads, don't we? We always kind of are thinking in terms of where we are and of what's happening. How does prophecy fit together? And our concern mostly is from today, from this point forward into the future. Where are we on that timeline? What's going to happen next? And maybe most critical to us, if the end of the age events were to happen in our lifetime, would we be prepared? Would we be able to deal with the events that would take place? This morning, I'm going to begin with you a review or an overview of this key prophecy, this Olivet prophecy. And the title I've given to the sermon, for lack of a better one, and the title I've given to this sermon is From Beginning to End. We can look back and put a number of markers on our timeline, but where we go into the future is what we're most concerned about, most interested in. Matthew 24. We'll start here. And by the way, this prophecy is also recorded in Mark 13 and in Luke 21. And we'll look at some verses from those chapters as well, because they're each of the gospel writers has a slightly different emphasis and adds a little more detail to the overall prophecy. Matthew 24, verse 1, we find the setting for this prophecy as Jesus gave it. Matthew 24, verse 1, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. No one knows just exactly what the temple looked like. It was a very impressive and a very extraordinary building. And the disciples, being Jews, were clearly proud of that building. It might be a little bit like one of us going to Washington, D.C. And there, in our nation's capital, there's many very impressive buildings that represent our history and that it represent us as a nation. And the temple was that and much more to the people, the Jews who lived in at that time. Here are a couple of notes from the Life Application Bible about the temple as the disciples showed it off, so to speak, to Jesus. It says that Herod had helped the Jews remodel it, the temple, no doubt to stay on friendly terms with them. Next to the inner temple, where the sacred objects were kept and the sacrifices offered, there was a large area called the Court of the Gentiles. Outside these courts were long porches. Solomon's porch, and we find an account in the Gospel of John of Jesus teaching from that location. Solomon's porch was along the side of the temple. It was 1,562 feet long. The royal porch was decorated with 160 columns along its 921-foot length. Gazing at this glorious and massive structure, the disciples found Jesus' words about its destruction difficult to believe. But the temple was indeed destroyed only 40 years later when the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 70 A.D., so it was a huge and beautiful, and very impressive edifice, and it represented to the Jewish people their history, their heritage, who they were. Read verse 2 here in Matthew 24, where Jesus told the disciples, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." Of course, there is still one wall of the temple that stands. It's called the Wailing Wall, and it is a part of this temple. So the prophecy that Jesus gave here, that not one stone would be left upon another, is yet to be fulfilled. There is more to come that will happen in that city of Jerusalem. Verse 3. "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" Now if you compare this to Mark's account, apparently it was some of the disciples who initially came to Jesus. Peter, James, John, and Andrew are mentioned in Mark 13 as the disciples who came to Jesus with this question. Most likely the others, as Jesus began to speak, gathered around as well. But it was to those four initially that Jesus began to answer the question. So sitting on the Mount of Olives, looking across the Kidron Valley to the temple, the disciples were probably in shock that Jesus had said their beloved temple would be destroyed. And they asked Jesus to explain further, to give them some indication of what it would mean. And of they took it beyond that immediate prophecy, recognizing that it would come at a time that would certainly be the end of everything they understood and knew, the end of the age. They asked specifically for the sign. Let's see. The sign of your coming and of the end of the age. A sign is an event that has special meaning. The word in the Greek means an event that has a significant or a special meaning. In this case, what they were asking for, of course, was an indication of what events would take place that would indicate that the time of Jesus' return was drawing close. The Lawanida lexicon points out that in some languages, the Greek that they used to ask this question would be translated or expressed as, "Tell us what will happen that will show that you are coming," or "Tell us what we will see that will make us know that you are coming." So they related this prophecy or this statement of Jesus to a time when things would change significantly, when Jesus Christ would come to establish the kingdom. Now, the question doesn't necessarily imply that they understood he was going to go spend 2,000 plus years at the Father's throne, but when he would establish the kingdom, what will be the sign so that we will know that that will happen and at the end of this age? They knew that the establishing of Jesus coming as the Messiah, as the King, would change everything. The word end, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? The Greek word used here means the completion of the various parts of a scheme or a plan. So it's in relation to the finishing of or the accomplishment of what Jesus Christ is going to accomplish. That's the end that they were looking to. You can use the word end in various ways, but again, here in this case, it means the completion of a plan. The end, the completion of the plan, the end of this age. We understand that the word age is what is correct here. The King James Version translates it the end of the world, but that's misleading. End of the age is correct. The Greek word is aeon, and it represents the period of time or an epoch, not the earth itself. So the period of time, a period of time, will end, and Jesus Christ will begin to a new time by his coming, by his taking his role as Messiah. A different but a similar word is also used in this chapter and translated end. We see it in verse 6. It says that the end is not yet. That's a different word with a similar meaning to what we see in verse 3. It's also used in verse 13, endure to the end. And verse 14, it says, then the end will come. In those three instances, a different Greek word is used. Again, it's very similar in meaning, but it adds a little bit more to the thought. This Greek word means to complete in final detail. To completely and totally, entirely complete. In this case, the implication is to complete that plan. So, the end of the age, then, is something that will occur when everything that has been planned is accomplished. It will occur when Jesus Christ returns and ushers in a new age. That is, after all, what the disciples asked. The end of this age was what they were asking Jesus Christ about. So the end, as it is expressed here, relates to the conclusion of everything that Christ says from this point forward in this prophecy. We're going to look at a couple of other passages. We'll be coming back to Matthew 24. Let's turn to Romans 9. We see here Paul is actually quoting from a passage in Isaiah, making reference to this same idea that there will come a time when the end will occur, when the plan will be completed. Romans 9, verse 28. For now, just going to look at the first phrase of this statement. It says, "For he will finish the work." The word finish here is that same Greek word that we saw in Matthew 24:6, that it is the completion and the final, every complete and total detail of the plan. He will finish that work. He's quoting from Isaiah 10. Let's go back and look at the, or paraphrasing, let's look at what Isaiah wrote. Isaiah 10, verse 22. Isaiah 10, 22. You notice in the couple of verses previous that it's speaking of the time when Jesus will begin to restore the nation of Israel after a punishment that is yet to come. We'll just pick up the thought here that Paul is quoting in chapter 10, verse 22. "For though your people, O Israel, be as the sand of the sea, a remnant of them will return. The destruction decreed shall overflow with righteousness, for the Lord God of hosts will make a determined end in the midst of all the land." God will complete, in this case, it's referring to the completion of the planned punishment that will come upon the nation of Israel. But it illustrates that there's a complete and total finality to this end. And the age that we are now in will come to an end. And it will do so not based on the problems then that can be resolved will be done not through the efforts of people, but by Jesus Christ when he returns. So when we look at this from a wide perspective, we see that events that take place on our timeline between now and the end, now in the time when Jesus Christ establishes God's kingdom, are the fulfillment of what must occur in order for God to complete his plan. We look at many of those events with kind of cringe as we look at them, as we consider them. But they're part of what God has planned, and they must be completed so that this age will come to an end, and the new age, the age of the rule of Jesus Christ, will begin. At that time, this world, this aeon, this age, will come to its conclusion. That's one reason why John, in his epistle, is emphatic in warning us not to put our heart in this world, in this age. 1 John chapter 2. Verse 15. John writes, "Do not love the world," the aeon, the age in which we live, "or the things in the world." It's easy to set our hearts on things that are part of this age. But if anyone loves the world or the age or puts it ahead of their love for God, then the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, everything about this world that we live in, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, none of that is of the Father, but it is of this world. And this world is passing away, and all the lust, everything that's part of it. but he who does the will of God abides forever. He who loves what is to come, rather than loving this world, this age, will be part of that next world and will be granted eternal life. Of course, for now, Satan has been allowed to influence, or pretty much to guide, this world. Again, there are scriptures we're very familiar with. For example, Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, which show us that Satan has been allowed to influence and to deceive mankind. It says in Revelation 12, 9, the great dragon was cast out, meaning referring to his being kicked out of or removed by force from heaven, where he had gone to try one more time to attack God's throne. He was cast out. That serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. Lucifer, of course, was how Satan started. And we read in Ezekiel and in Isaiah what a powerful being he was. And God allowed him to maintain that power. God used his rebellion to further and to complete the plan that he's working. So Satan has deceived mankind. Satan has been given that freedom, that authority, that power. But Satan is limited. His time, his authority, what he can do is only within the greater plan that God has. We look at the world and we see Satan's influence in it, and we wonder sometimes, well, where's God? You know, why does he allow these things? It's part of his plan. It's part of what he's going to implement or allow or bring about so that he can accomplish his purpose, which is to end this age and to begin the new age, the age when Jesus Christ will rule. Now, as we're looking at this, I know it's a very basic review for many, but it's important for us to keep it in mind, because we do carry this timeline around in our head. And it's important for us to be able to recognize and to perceive, to process what we see happening, and to see how it fits with what we know of God's plan and what Jesus revealed here in this prophecy. So let's go back to Matthew 24. What is it that needs to be completed? What is it that needs to be accomplished so that this age can come to its conclusion? Well, we see some of that here in the balance of this prophecy. Not everything, not every detail is given here. We have to go to other scriptures as well to fill in more understanding. But we see here the answer that Jesus gave to his disciples. What is the sign of his coming, that is, of his coming in authority to take control, and of the end of the age? Verse 5 here in Matthew 24. The thought, of course, begins in verse 4. Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Now, that's a general statement that we have, that we understand to be a warning from Jesus that there will be others who would present a different teaching about him, that they would use his name, but they would not present the same teachings that he gave, that they would, in effect, just kind of use his name to teach false things about him. And we recognize that that's happened so much in the religious world today. Many consider themselves Christians, but don't honestly follow the teachings of Jesus Christ. and many claim to teach about Jesus, but they're not teaching the message that Jesus gave. So there have been those who, from the very beginning, almost the day of or the day after Jesus died on the stake, that a deception began. Many, it says, will come in my name, saying, I'm the Christ. Paul warned of another gospel. He refers to that in Galatians chapter 1, verse 6. He warns of another Jesus or another spirit in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 4. So that kind of deception has been, it's part of the deception, that universal deception that Satan has shrouded the truth in, that most of the world is affected by, at least most of the Christian world. So that is, it's true that many have come in his name and falsely represented him. But however, in this context, in the context here that when Jesus made this statement, it seems to be specifically warning that many would come claiming to bear the message about the time of the end of the age. That is the specific deception that Jesus is warning about. That was the question that they asked. They wanted to know about the sign of his coming and the end of the age. And Jesus' first comment in answer to that is that many would come in his name claiming to speak on behalf of Christ or the message of Christ, but would deceive many. Compare this, as I said, we're going to look at the other versions of this prophecy as well. Compare this to Luke chapter 21, verse 8. Luke 21, verse 8. And by the way, we don't see any contradiction between these three versions, but we see that one will add a little more detail to help us understand. Luke 21, verse 8. Jesus is quoted here as saying, "Take heed that you not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and the time has drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them." So it's again seems to be the specific warning that there will be those who would come claiming that they some information or some insight into the end of the age. I think we see that quite a lot. There are many confusing messages, many interpretations of prophecy, a lot of predictions. In fact, some that make true prophecy seem ridiculous. You find from time to time these people that predict that Jesus will return on a specific date, and they all go up on the mountain and they sell their houses and they're waiting for the spaceship. And they're people who just speak of the time of the end of the age and of the return of Jesus Christ in a way that is ridiculous, and it makes true understanding seem absurd. But they have this false message claiming to represent Jesus Christ and the message about the end of the age. So I think we can understand this. Let's go back to Matthew 24. I think we understand this then on both levels. It is speaking about the general deception, the false teaching about Christ, but also in this context, it's more specifically warning of those who would claim to teach about the end of the age, to claim to answer this question that the disciples had asked. So, continuing, it says, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars." Well, obviously, that has been something that has always been the case throughout mankind's history, but we see it intensifying now. Wars, we hear of wars, and rumors of wars simply means reports of wars. It's not a rumor in that it's, you know, a story that may or may not be true that someone is telling about something. But the word rumor would better be be translated report. So you hear about wars and reports of wars. And, you know, as you know, and as Mr. Franks highlighted in the letter that he sent us this week, there's never been a time when there's been more of that than we can remember. Now, some may recall the Second World War and the events there. But this is just a matter of so many different wars that are taking place. He goes on in this verse, you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. Again, see, it's part of the plan. It's part of what has to occur so that the end can come about. But it says the end is not yet. The end of the age is something that we might anticipate much sooner than it really will come, because we'll see these reports and we'll see the evidence of or the effect of wars that are becoming more and more of a concern. But don't be troubled, he said. The word troubled here means startled or alarmed, and so. We don't have to be taken by surprise when these kinds of things are happening. There are other warnings about not being troubled, and that protection from being startled or alarmed or shaken is based on our understanding of prophecies of what we truly can see. From this prophecy, that these things have to happen. They're going to happen. They must occur so that the end can come about, but it hasn't happened yet. Paul warned about that kind of troubling news in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We'll just look at this quickly. There are other examples of a reminder not to be easily shaken, easily confused, or to perhaps to exaggerate have an exaggerated response to things that we see happening. When we recognize, as we can, that events such as those that we are seeing are part of the plan that God is working, then it helps us to put them in a better perspective. That is the world out of control? It's unraveling, but is it out of control? No, it is all taking place within the plan that God has established. And we don't take it lightly, but at least we can put it in the proper perspective. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1 says, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, in our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." Here's an example right here of Paul pointing out that there were some who had come claiming to bring a message about the end of the age, and they were troubling the people of God, because they were presenting that as if it were from Paul himself. And so Jesus is warning us, don't be troubled, don't be shaken, because you know these things. I'm revealing them to you so that you can have that view, you can have that understanding. So back to Matthew 24. We've seen that there will be deception, especially about the conditions at the end of the age. There'll be wars and rumors of wars. And then verse 7, the wars here are seen to be intensified. It says, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. So that seems to be kind of expanding the concept of war, possibly a description of a world war, where nations and kingdoms are battling and at war. And it says there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. A similar description is given in Mark 13, verse 8. Mark 13, we'll just look at this parallel version of the prophecy. Well, we can pick it up in verse 7, where Jesus says, "When you hear of wars and reports or rumors of wars, do not be troubled. Don't be startled. Don't be taken by surprise, because these things must happen. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be earthquakes in various places and famines and troubles." Again, a similar description of the kinds of events that will take place. And you could also read that very similar description in Luke 21, verses 10 and 11. Then an interesting statement is made in Matthew 24, verse 8. Matthew 24, verse 8. Jesus says, "All these are the beginning of sorrows." This is just the start. We're looking for the end. That's what we're anticipating. That's what we are looking forward to. But Jesus says that the kinds of things that we're observing, the kinds of things that are described here in the previous verse, the international wars, the famines, the pestilence, the earthquakes, these, Jesus says, are the beginning of sorrows. He's emphasizing the point, it seems, because he recognizes that we will look at events, we will look at situations, and we'll say, "Wow, it can't get any worse than that. You know, Jesus Christ's return must be coming really soon. He has to come back to stop this." But he wants us to understand that these kinds of events that are taking place are significant. They are signs. That's what the disciples were asking for. But we should not be troubled or panicked or put them in the wrong place on the timeline. We should recognize that Jesus prophesied catastrophic events that would take place before the worst events happen at the time of the tribulation. Now, that's not good news. That's not something that's pleasant. It's not something that we'll enjoy seeing as we watch what's happening in the world around us, but it does, again, help us put these situations in context. And when we watch the news, we can understand that, yeah, these things are supposed to happen. Jesus Christ is still in charge. The world is not out of control. It's under his control. And we have to recognize that it's allowed for. And as he said earlier, these things must happen so that the end will come. So, again, the beginning, by definition, is the point in time at the start of a sequence. These are the beginning of things that will happen. The kind of events that we made that take place around us today that have been part of the history of mankind since Jesus' time, and for that matter, even before, are part of what Jesus Christ is allowing and what he will accomplish his plan through those events. The beginning of sorrows. The word sorrows is interesting. It's from a Greek word that means birth pangs, the pain of childbirth or labor. For example, the New Revised Standard Version and several others as well express it this way. In verse 8, all of this is but the beginning of birth pangs. And so the kind of pain that will occur is compared to a woman's pain of labor. Paul, of course, used that same kind of a comparison in 1 Thessalonians 5. It talks about the pains of labor coming suddenly upon a woman, and the same way it will come upon mankind. So some of the commentaries refer, have coined the phrase that these events that are being described here are the birth pangs of the Messiah. It's the pain that that people will go through in anticipation of or looking ahead to the time of Jesus Christ's arrival. Let's continue in Matthew 24, in verse 9. It says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake, and many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. So it seems again to be relating these false prophets to those who would be explaining or offering a false message about the time or the events that lead to the end of the age. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Those who faithfully follow Jesus Christ, his disciples, or as we would think of it, the members of the Church of God, have, in times past, suffered terrible persecution. We live in kind of a little bubble of history during which persecution has not been an issue, at least in our nation. We see an example, again, right now of the kind of persecution that can come upon those religious persecution. Now, the people that are in Iraq right now that are suffering so terribly are not Christians. In fact, the religion that is being persecuted now, what I understand, is predates Christianity and the Muslim religion, or Islam. But it's different from that Islamic religion, and so they are the target of those extremists. Religious persecution is one of the most brutal and hostile forms of evil that has ever been perpetrated on the people that take out on one another. God's people have also, in the past, suffered terrible persecution. And prophecy that we'll see elsewhere says that it will happen again in the future. So this is a general picture, then, of the fact that the world, and Jesus said elsewhere, that the world will hate you because it hates me. And there will come a time, again, at the end of the age, when those who follow Jesus Christ faithfully and truthfully will be punished or will be persecuted. I won't take the time right now, but you could review this same thought in the other two versions of the prophecy in Mark 13, verses 9 through 13, is a parallel to this passage that we just looked at, and also Luke 21, verses 12 through 19. Those passages are very similar in the way that they describe the persecution. In fact, they add more detail. They both, in both Mark and Luke, adds the thought that when you are brought into a situation to witness, then don't be concerned about what you will say. That God, by His Spirit, would help you to say what needs to be said to defend your understanding or your belief. Let's do look at one passage here in Luke 21. want to kind of summarize here what we've seen so far. Luke 21, verse 10. Luke 21, verse 10. We saw this earlier in Matthew 24, but Jesus says here, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, famines and pestilences. There will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. So what we find in verses 10 through 12 here is something that we've noted in the past, that this prophecy, these matters, these conditions that are spoken of here seem to correspond to the opening of the first six seals in Revelation 6. Verses 10, 11, and 12, you can find are fulfilled as well by the opening of those seals. Let's look just very briefly at Revelation 6. This tells us a couple of things. First of all, Jesus Christ prophesied that these events would be ongoing from the time of his death all the way through to the end of the age. These kinds of events have been occurring and reoccurring. But Revelation 6 will help us to understand that at the end of the age, there will be an intensified level of each of these conditions, each of these trends. So, yes, these things already have happened, but in the future, they will become, the same things will be occurring, but will be more intense in their occurrence. Revelation 5 introduces the scroll that no one is able to open except for Jesus Christ. And this scroll is sealed by a number of different, it's sealed a number of different places. And as each seal is opened, the scroll opens partially and reveals a prophecy. So that's what these seals are all about. And we see in verse 1, the description of a white horse and one who sits on the horse who has a bow and goes forth to conquer. Now, it's a bit, it's not perfectly clear, but we look at other verses and we see that this is apparently the description of a deceptive religious leader. One who appears to be white. We find in Revelation, I think it's chapter 13, that there's a lamb that seems to be a lamb, but it really speaks as a dragon. This is one that appears to be white, representing righteousness. We know from 2 Corinthians 11 that Satan appears as an angel. He appears to be righteous. That's part of his deception. So this particular seal seems to be addressing the condition of a strong, deceptive, false religion. The second seal is open in verse 3, and these first four are represented by horses, of course, as you're familiar. These are the four horsemen, as they're sometimes referred to. This second one is sitting on a red horse, and he takes peace from the earth, and is given to him a great sword. So that clearly represents warfare, which is something that Jesus spoke of in Matthew, in the Olivet prophecy. Verse 5 is the third of these seals, this third horse. It's a black horse. He has scales in his hand, and he is measuring out and rationing food. A quart of wheat for a denarius, and be careful not to harm the oil and the wine. So it's implying a scarcity of food or the condition of famine, as Jesus spoke of. Verse 7 introduces the third or the fourth horse. It's a pale horse, and it is sent, given power over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, hunger, and death, and by the beasts of the field. This is a general condition of pestilence. In other words, just the word pestilence means death. And this is kind of probably a cumulative condition where war leads to famine, and drought can lead to disease epidemics. And so it's just kind of a general description of death and of destruction that comes about. Then we see the opening of the fifth seal in verse 9, and it speaks of those who had been slain for the word of God. So all of these events are among those that Jesus prophesied would be the beginning of sorrows, would be the beginning of the events that would lead to the conclusion or to the end. So we find here that these seals then represent the same kind of conditions, but their emphasis here and they're being opened in this vision of the day of the Lord, which is what Revelation is all about, indicates that they will take place again at the time of the end of the age, with much more intensity. So that's why, as we read back in Matthew 24 now, verse 13. Matthew 24, verse 13. We read that he who endures to the end shall be saved. It's both a promise and a warning. It's a warning that there is going to be the need for endurance, that this is not going to be an easy time for those who experience it, that when those who are alive at this point have these kinds of experiences, it's going to be very difficult. All of the world is going to be affected by them. And it's a time that will require a great deal of strength and of courage. Patience and faith and strength will be necessary. So there's a warning there, but there's also a promise that those who do endure will be saved. Those who do endure will come out of that circumstance. So these are personal characteristics that we need to develop, the strength and the faith and the patience, as well as the understanding that we need to have of events as they will begin to occur. Now, I say we will need these things and that this will happen. We don't know. Back to the timeline. We don't know where we are on that timeline. But Jesus gave this prophecy so that those upon whom these events would occur, to whom these events would occur, would understand, would be able to see. And so it's a matter of that we aren't certain when these events will continue or how far they will continue in our lifetime. But they are certain. We'll see that as we continue into the chapter a little later. There's no doubt that these events will take place. So there are characteristics that we need to develop so that we can be able to endure if these events were to happen in our lifetime. So it's important for us to understand what Jesus was talking about. It's important for us to maintain a focus so that we understand what's happening in the world around us and how it might fit on this understanding of the sequence of events. For today, let's go back and conclude in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. In order to develop these qualities that we've touched upon here in from verse 13, the strength to endure, the patience and the faith that we'll need to stand up under these difficult circumstances that could, if they were to happen in our lives. matter of it being important for us to understand these things, but there's also the importance of developing that personal strength. This is something that God's people have always done through every age. I find that the summary here that Paul gives in 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 9, to be really interesting. Speaking about the people in Thessalonica who had recently formed into a church, this was one of the early letters. So the church at Thessalonica was established early in Paul's ministry. And shortly after he established the church, he wrote this epistle to them to encourage them because they were encountering some very serious difficulties. But verse 9, we pick it up, that they themselves declare concerning us what manner of entry we had to you. In other words, people saw the way that Paul worked as he established the church. But here's the point we want to look at. And how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven. Those are the two things that God's people have always done. As they're called, as they're brought into an understanding of the truth, so that we can worship God in spirit and in truth, we turn to God from our previous way of life. You didn't literally bow down to idols, but you lived prior to your calling an idolatrous life, serving the wrong gods. You turned from the wrong way of worship, the wrong way of life, to serve the living and the true God. That's the first step, and it leads us to live in a certain way, to be obedient, to be faithful, to be consistent, to be diligent, to have the qualities we need because we're now serving the living God. And, secondly, to wait for his Son from heaven. This is what God's people have done all throughout the history of the church. We're turned to God, we learn to worship him and to honor him and to serve him, and we faithfully wait for his Son to return. As we watch, as we are learning to serve God, we are aware of the signs that Jesus revealed that would indicate the progress of events along this timeline that would lead to the end of this age and the beginning of the new age of God's kingdom. As we watch that progression, at the same time we are learning to live a righteous and obedient life, looking to and waiting for, anxiously waiting for, the return of his Son. We'll continue our review another time, see other aspects of the prophecy that Jesus gave, so that we can keep in mind what he revealed to the disciples when they asked for the sign of his coming and of the end of the age.